Dilly beans. Fresh green or yellow or purple beans preserved with dill are known as dilly beans. I grew up eating my father's excellent dilly beans, and to this day, every time I visit him, he pulls out a jar of them to share, and we enjoy them as a crunchy, sour, and light snack while dinner cooks. My dad pickles his dilly beans by stuffing beans in a wide-mouth canning jar with dill, garlic, chili peppers, salt, and celery seed, pouring a boiling mix of half vinegar, half water over them. Sealing and heat processing by boiling in a hot water bath for 10 minutes. Dilly beans may also be fermented under brine. Mix 5% brine, roughly 3 tablespoons of salt per quart/liter of water, and submerge beans in it, along with lots of dill and garlic. Fermentation time will vary with temperature. Some of the literature recommends cooking beans before fermenting. They contain a toxic substance called facin, a protein that interferes with digestion and decomposes when heated, according to Klaus Kaufmann and Annelies Schunek. Never eat raw beans on a salad plate, they admonish, recommending boiling beans for 5 to 10 minutes in salted water before eating or fermenting. Having enjoyed raw string beans all my life, without noticeable toxicity, it's hard for me to worry about facin. I've only found a few references to facin as a toxin that cite any specific sources. One is a 1962 citation of a 1926 German study in which mice were unable to grow on the isolated protein, facin, of the white bean, Phacelus vulgaris, unless it was cooked. This hardly seems relevant. A string bean isn't a white bean, and we are not mice being fed a diet of exclusively an isolated protein derived from it. It probably is not healthy to eat just an isolate of any single food, including beans. The other reference I found was from botanist James Duke, who summarizes a report from a German medical journal in 1979. After eating only a few raw beans, Phacelus vulgaris, or dried beans, P. coccineus, 3 boys, 4 to 8 years old, rapidly developed symptoms of poisoning, notably sickness and diarrhea. Facin, a toxalbumin destroyed by cooking, was considered responsible. All boys had normal aminotransferase values, and parenteral treatment with fluid and electrolytes led to complete recovery in 12 to 24 hours. Note that the boys ate raw beans or dried beans. That really is a significant distinction. Dried beans definitely contain toxic antinutrients, and in some varieties, fresh green beans do too. Only certain varieties of beans are eaten green, even cooked, and fermentation is generally an effective means of removing such compounds and transforming them into other benign or even nutritious forms. It's hard for me to worry about fermenting raw string beans. Nonetheless, I have tried Kaufmann and Schunek's method of pre-cooking the beans, and despite my initial skepticism, since the lactic acid bacteria present on raw vegetables are destroyed by cooking, the blanched beans fermented beautifully, thanks to the presence of raw garlic and dill with lactic acid bacteria still intact. Lactic acid fermentations of fruit. Various fruits have already been mentioned in this chapter as minor ingredients of vegetable ferments, but it seems appropriate to devote a section to lactic acid fermentations of fruit. Typically, sugary fruit and fruit juice will spontaneously ferment into primarily alcohol, and then acetic acid if exposed to air, rather than lactic acid. Chapter 4 details different methods for fermenting fruit into alcohol. Ferments mixing fruits with vegetables generally contain both yeasts and lactic acid bacteria. In fruit kimchi, fruit is mixed with salted and spiced vegetables, fruits ferment primarily into alcohol and acetic acid, while vegetables ferment primarily into lactic acid. To enjoy fruit kimchi with fruit still somewhat sweet, eat or refrigerate after just a few days' fermentation. Yeast activity can be inhibited by heavy salting, or overpowered by the addition of lactic acid starter cultures such as whey. One popular lactic acid fermentation of fruit is salted lemons and limes. Madhur Jaffrey's book, World Vegetarian, contains a simple recipe for Moroccan-style salted lemons, calling for 2 pounds, or 1 kilogram, of lemons and 9 tablespoons of salt. Cut the lemons into quarters lengthwise, leaving them attached at the bottoms. Remove the seeds and rub the lemons with most of the salt inside and out, closing them up again so they look whole. Use a quart jar as a vessel. Sprinkle salt into the bottom of the jar, then add the salted lemons one by one, pressing down to force the juice out of the lemons, until they are all in the jar, submerged under brine. Ferment 3 to 4 weeks until the lemon skins have softened completely, then refrigerate. Both the skin and pulp add sourness, notes Jaffrey, but it is a special mellow sourness with echoes of an ancient world. Salting of lemons varies quite a bit among recipes. Another recipe I found used much less salt, 4 tablespoons for 10 pounds, 4.5 kilograms, of lemons. Once again, there is not a single way of doing this. You can similarly ferment limes, oranges, or other citrus fruits. In fact, Sally Fallon Morell writes that originally marmalade was a lacto-fermented food, in which oranges were pressed into large casks with seawater. Another example of a heavily salted fruit ferment is the Japanese pickled plum known as umeboshi. The salty and sour fermented plums are used as both seasoning and medicine in Japan. Aveline Kushi, the Japanese author of several macrobiotic cookbooks, recounts a Japanese adage, "Eat one umeboshi plum before taking a journey and you will have a safe trip." The ume plums, Prunus mume, are harvested green, not fully ripe. The red color of umeboshi plums comes from the leaves of perilla, also known as beefsteak plant, or shiso in Japanese, Perilla frutescens. My friend, Alwin Dewali, who spent time 40 years ago living with the Katsuragi family in a farming village in southwestern Japan, recorded in his journal his host mother's method of pickling umeboshi plums. For every 1.5 quarts/liters of plums, you'll need 1 pint or 1/2 liter of sea salt and 3.5 ounces, 100 grams, perilla leaves, about 50 leaves, plus another 2 tablespoons of sea salt. In Japan, the plums to be used are gathered in mid-June when they are beginning to turn yellow but are still green. Fully ripe plums will disintegrate in pickling. Wash the plums well and leave to stand overnight in clear water. Then drain off the water and put the plums and salt in alternating layers into a crock. Put a heavy rock on top of the last layer of plums. A day or two later, when enough liquid has been drawn off the plums by the salt to cover the plums completely, remove the rock and put a cover on the crock. Wait about 20 days. When you expect to have 3 good hot days without rain, drain the liquid, umeboshi vinegar, off the plums and put the plums outside to dry in the sun. They should be spread out in a single layer, ideally on propped-up baskets or screens so that air can circulate above and below them. Leave them spread out like this for 3 days and nights. During that time, mix 2 heaping tablespoons of salt into the perilla leaves and squeeze by hand until you've expressed all the purple liquid you can. The liquid is thrown away. Then add the leaves to the sun-dried plums as you put the plums back in the crock. Pour back in enough of the plum vinegar to cover the plums completely. The remaining vinegar can be used in cooking. And put the lid on the crock again. The following summer, remove the plums again, dry in the sun for 1 day, and put in jars for storage without the vinegar. These are real umeboshi. They will be very salty at first, but will gradually become less salty and more delicious. Fermentation enthusiast Andrew Donaldson wrote to me raving about cranberries fermented in brine, which he mixed at a proportion of 2 tablespoons salt per quart/liter of water. In the mountainous regions of Bulgaria, cranberries are preserved with only water poured over them, no salt, and they are remarkable for their good flavor, according to ethnologist Lilia Radeva. Anne Volokh, in her book The Art of Russian Cuisine, has recipes for brining apples and watermelons. For the apples, she mixes a sweet brine, dissolving 3.5 tablespoons, or 50 milliliters, of sugar and 1.75 tablespoons, or 25 milliliters, of salt in 3 quarts, or 3 liters of water, and mixing in 6 tablespoons, or 90 milliliters, of rye flour. Then, in a gallon vessel, Volokh layers whole tart cooking apples on their sides with tarragon and sour cherry leaves, pours the brine over them, weighs them down, and covers. She ferments the apples at room temperature for a few days, then moves them to a cellar or refrigerator for a month or longer. For watermelon, she uses only small melons, 3.5 pounds or 1.5 kilograms or smaller, and ferments them whole in 5% brine, brining earlier in this chapter, spiced with whole cloves and cinnamon sticks for 40 to 50 days at cellar or refrigerator temperatures. She describes the brined watermelons as having an incomparable, cool, prickling, sweet and sour taste. Fruits can also be fermented with vegetables. Earlier we touched upon small proportions of fruit mixed into mostly vegetable ferments, and just the reverse can be done as well. Rick Chumley wrote me about his pineapple mango chutney, combining and fermenting for a few days chopped pineapple and mango, along with radishes, onions, cilantro, lime juice, tarragon, ginger, and black pepper, salt, and whey as a starter. Local Roots Cafe Black Mission Fig Butter by Reeves Elliott. Makes 1 quart/liter. 4 cups, 1 liter, dried Black Mission figs. 1 tablespoon, 15 milliliters, sea salt. 1/4 cup, 60 milliliters, whey. 1/4 to 1/2 cup, 60 to 125 milliliters, raw honey to taste. Water as necessary. 1. De-stem the figs and soak for 1 hour in warm water. 2. Process all the ingredients together until smooth in a food processor. Add water as necessary at this point to allow the processor blades to blend smoothly and not overheat. 3. Pour the mixture into your 1 quart/liter mason jar. If necessary, add water and stir until the fig butter reaches within 1 to 1 1/2 inches, or 2.54 centimeters of the brim. 4. Seal the jar tightly with the lid and leave it room temperature for 2 days, or until bubbly. Then transfer to the top shelf of your refrigerator. In 3 weeks to a month, it will be sufficiently delicious. Eat within 2 months. Fruit ferments can be cultured with whey, sauerkraut, or kimchi juice, or any other lactic acid bacteria starter. Sally Fallon Morell has a number of recipes in this vein in her book, Nourishing Traditions. Reeves Elliott, who founded Local Roots Cafe, a locavore restaurant in Roanoke, Virginia, made a delicious lacto-fermented raw fig butter that stands out in my memory. Really, you could take any raw or cooked fruit concoction, cool it down to body temperature if it's cooked, add a live lactic acid bacteria starter, and ferment. Just be sure, if you ferment fruit with lots of sugar in jars, to release pressure from the jars, because with so much sugar there is the potential of building considerable pressure and exploding jars. Kawal. Kawal is made by fermenting the leaves of a wild leguminous plant also known as kawal, Cassia obtusifolia, used as a flavoring and meat substitute in Darfur, Sudan. Kawal is a food of some of the very poorest Africans, writes Hamid Dirar, who adds that it is shunned by the elite who consider it unfit for modern social life because of its repugnant, fetid odor that lingers on the fingers for hours. Nonetheless, kawal is spreading across Sudan. The displaced carried with them the know-how of kawal preparation and use to areas where the raw material, the wild legume, is found in abundance, but the inhabitants were not aware of the fermentation process. The process for making kawal is pretty straightforward. Leaves are harvested when plants are fully grown, but still green and tender, as flowers and seed pods first begin to develop. Harvested leaves are cleaned of debris and beaten into a green paste with a mortar and pestle. Kawal is typically fermented in a clay pot, burma, buried in the ground. A cool kitchen or cellar would be fine. The green paste is packed into the vessel and the surface covered with green sorghum leaves, which are weighed down by stones. Every 3 to 4 days the jar is opened, the now yellow and dry sorghum leaves removed, and the contents of the burma thoroughly hand-mixed and repacked with fresh sorghum leaves. Within a week or so, the fermenting kawal develops a characteristic strong odor which stays with it until it is consumed. Two signals herald the maturity of the fermenting kawal. The first is the appearance of a yellowish pickle on the surface of the paste, and the second is a drop in temperature of the paste from the warmer temperature of active fermentation to that of ambience. At the end of the fermentation, the separated juice is reincorporated into its mother paste, which is in turn kneaded well and crushed between the fingers. The paste is next fed into small irregular balls or flattish cakes, which are then sun-dried for 3 to 4 days. The dried kawal cakes can be stored for a year or more. They are traditionally mixed with water for sauces, though urban people use ground kawal by sprinkling it on the food, much like pepper. Adding starters to vegetable ferments. All vegetables are pre-inoculated with native lactic acid bacteria adequate to initiate fermentation. In my own practice, I have found the bacteria on vegetables to consistently produce successful and delicious ferments, and almost all the varied traditions of fermenting vegetables that I have learned about rely upon bacteria present on the vegetables. You do not need any special cultures in order to ferment vegetables. Nonetheless, many people prefer to add cultures, selected strains and/or concentrated populations of lactic acid bacteria, to speed or better control fermentation. In addition to commercially available laboratory-bred bacterial strains, people use mature sauerkraut juice or brine, kombucha, kefir, or whey as starters. The idea of adding starter cultures to vegetables has been investigated by researchers for nearly a century, since early in the emergence of the field of microbiology. Most research has concluded that in this context, starters are impractical and unnecessary, since the organisms responsible for fermentation occur naturally in adequate numbers, and proper fermentation will occur if temperature and salt concentration are suitable. Typically in such research, what constitutes suitable conditions are a salt concentration of approximately 2% and a temperature around 65 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 degrees Celsius. Where starter cultures have been found to be effective is in ferments with lower salt concentrations. We have shown that fermenting with 50% less salt results in increased variability among many quality factors, including unpredictable softening and generation of off flavors, reports a 2007 study in the Journal of Food Science. Addition of L. mesenteroides starter culture provided the appropriate fermentation regardless of salt level, ensuring the production of high-quality sauerkraut. Note that the problems attributed to low-salt ferments are aesthetic considerations of texture and flavor rather than safety. Compensating for low salt levels with shorter fermentation times can prevent these flavor and texture degradations. With or without starters, regardless of salt level, fermentation of raw vegetables is intrinsically safe. I have periodically added mature brine to a new batch of vegetables without observing any dramatic difference in fermentation speed or product quality. But pickle-making enthusiast Ira Weiss strongly recommends it. Adding a cup of the finished brine to a fresh batch of brine and cukes acts as a very effective starter and will reduce fermentation time. At about 72 degrees Fahrenheit or 22 degrees Celsius, the pickles become full sour in 4 to 5 days instead of 7 to 10. In my research, I came across several references in the literature discouraging this practice in sauerkraut. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization report summarizes, "The efficacy of using old juice depends largely on the types of organisms present in the juice and its acidity. If the starter juice has an acidity of 0.3% or more, it results in a poor quality kraut. This is because the cocci, leucognostic mesenteroides, which would normally initiate fermentation are suppressed by the high acidity, leaving the bacilli with sole responsibility for fermentation. If the starter juice has an acidity of 0.25% or less, the kraut produced is normal, but there do not appear to be any beneficial effects of adding this juice. Often, the use of old juice produces a sauerkraut which has a softer texture than normal. I have heard about people similarly using mature kombucha liquid as a starter, and even people using kombucha mothers to convert the surface of the vegetables. A popular website devoted to kefir, created by an Australian kefir aficionado named Dominic Anfiteatro, promotes the idea of using excess kefir grains, either traditional kefir grains for culturing milk, or what are known as water or sugary kefir grains, or both, to culture vegetables. He blends the granules with a little carrot and apple juice and mixes the resulting kefir grain emulsion in with the vegetables, with or without salt, to ferment. The process is very flexible, writes Dom on his website. For you can either use whole kefir grains, putting these first at the bottom of the container and then again halfway up the container when half of all ingredients are put in the brewing container. Or kefir grains may be blended with water or fresh fruit/veggie juice and mixing the mash or emulsion with the pounded ingredients, then filling the brewing container with the fresh ingredients. Or, a few kefir grains may be pounded together with amounts of fresh veggies, and filling the brewing vessel as you go. Any of these methods produce a superior kefir kraut in little time, all of the time. The homemade starter culture in most widespread use for fermenting vegetables is live culture whey. This is the starter advocated by Sally Fallon Morell. Whey is the liquid that separates from the fatty curds when milk curdles. Depending upon how the milk curdled, whey may or may not contain live cultures. For instance, if milk is heated and then acidified by the addition of vinegar, whey will result. but because the milk was heated, the whey will not contain live bacteria. Similarly, whey protein powders marketed to bodybuilders contain no live cultures. Only if milk is cultured and then curdled by acidification or rennet enzyme action without heat, or raw milk is allowed to spontaneously acidify, will the resulting whey contain live bacteria. The easiest sources of whey are kefir and yogurt. Kefir will spontaneously separate after 2 or 3 days of fermentation, and whey can be simply poured off. Be gentle, or the curds and whey may reintegrate. With yogurt, place a colander over a bowl, line it with several layers of tightly woven cheesecloth, and scoop yogurt into it. Then gather the corners of the cheesecloth and gently and evenly lift them. Whey will begin to drip out into the bowl. Find a hook, nail, or other spot where you can hang the yogurt-filled cheesecloth as whey continues to drip out of it. The longer you leave it hanging, the firmer the yogurt becomes and the more whey accumulates. In addition to these homemade starters, which amount to harnessing already vigorous microbial activity and moving it into a new substrate, there are a number of laboratory-bred starter cultures commercially available. As an experiment while working on this book, I tried a starter produced by Caldwell Biofermentation Canada. I shredded 2 pounds, 1 kilogram, of cabbage and added 1.8% salt. Then I cultured half with the Caldwell starter and let the other half spontaneously ferment, as I usually do. The batch with starter definitely exhibited a more dramatic initial decrease in pH, but while the control did not acidify quite so quickly, it too came into the safety zone, pH below 4.6, in less than 24 hours. Both batches tasted good and had similar texture. I continue to regard the use of commercial starter cultures as unnecessary, even though they can speed fermentation and acidification. The central criticism I have of them is how they are generally marketed, which is by exploiting fear and exaggerating the risk associated with spontaneous fermentation. Caldwell Biofermentation states on its website that spontaneous fermentations of vegetables can even be risky. When I questioned this, they sent me a study they conducted with the Canadian government comparing ferments using starters with spontaneous ferments. The study confirmed the idea that pH drops faster with a starter, which I do not contest, but it also made blanket statements not supported by the findings of the study, such as, the indigenous flora of the vegetables can contain molds, yeasts, or even pathogens which may cause health risk. Indeed, vegetable flora may contain all these elements, and yet because of the predictability of acidification and the resulting suppression of pathogens, they pose no risk, except in a purely theoretical way. Recall the statement from the USDA's vegetable fermentation specialist, Fred Bright. There has never been a documented case of foodborne illness from fermented vegetables. Risky is not a word I would use to describe vegetable fermentation. Use starter cultures if you wish, but do not do so from a place of fear. The spontaneous fermentation of vegetables, for all its variability, is a safe process, proven by the tests of time. Liquid forms of vegetable ferments, beet and lettuce kvass, cultured cabbage juice, kanji, and shalgam suyu. Mostly vegetables are fermented in a solid state, generating liquid, but in modest proportions. The liquid has strong flavor and can be drunk as a powerful digestive tonic. Joy of Cooking, 1975 edition, calls sauerkraut juice a decoction for heroes. By fermenting vegetables in a high proportion of water, vegetable nutrients infuse into the liquid, resulting in delicious, sour, live-culture tonic beverages. Beet kvass, also known as beet rasol, meaning brine, is a fermented infusion of beets in water, lightly salted. I usually make beet kvass in a quart jar. Chop a large beet or 2 small ones into 1/2 inch, 1 centimeter, cubes. Cover with water to mostly fill the jar. Add a pinch of salt and whey or other starters if you like. Ferment a few days, exactly how many days depends upon temperature, specific ingredients and ratios, microbial ecology, and flavor preferences. Taste daily. When it starts to develop a deep, dark color and a pleasing strength, strain out the beets. You can enjoy beet kvass just like that. As a beverage, use it as a base for borscht. Or lightly carbonate by transferring the liquid to a sealable vessel that can hold a little pressure, sealing and leaving a day more at room temperature. Sally Fallon Morrell suggests adding a little whey to the beet water and writes that beet kvass is an excellent blood tonic, promotes regularity, aids digestion, alkalinizes the blood, cleanses the liver, and is a good treatment for kidney stones and other ailments. Lettuce kvass is made just like beet kvass, only replacing the chopped beets with chopped lettuce. I heard about lettuce kvass from two Canadian women who have been piecing together the story of it. Gail Singer grew up in Winnipeg, the daughter of Romanian Jewish immigrants, and the daughter of a father who made many kinds of pickles, including lettuce pickles, which he called salata. Years after his death, she became interested in lettuce pickles and could find no information. Through the internet, she found some other people with memories of lettuce kvass or pickles, and she found food historian Alexandra Grigorieva, a Russian immigrant to Canada. Right now, the proof that such lettuce dishes ever existed consists of about 30 testimonials, including Gail's, all of them belonging to Jewish culture, writes Grigorieva, who mapped and charted the details of the testimonials she and Singer collected. The only persons who are aware of this dish hail from Jewish families, mostly from just a few certain regions of Ukraine within the Pale of Settlement. Grigorieva views these ferments as practical strategies to remove the bitterness of lettuce, sometimes known in Yiddish as schmatz, rags. She describes lettuce pickles and lettuce kvass as variations on the same theme, with vinegar and light brine versions often crisscrossing and merging. Lettuce kvass, a slightly greenish refreshing lettuce drink, is made by fermenting roughly torn lettuce leaves in slightly salted and sometimes subtly sugared water with dill and garlic, according to Grigorieva. The reason so little is remembered of the tradition is that the shtetl culture that spawned it was displaced and annihilated. No wonder we have so few memories of what must have been once a summer staple all over Ukraine, either in pickled or in kvass form. The few people that still persevere with these culinary traditions mostly live well away from the original shtetl land of their families in Israel, Canada, the United States, Russia, and even Germany. Cultured cabbage juice is another fermented vegetable in liquid form, though really it is an infusion rather than a juice. To make it, fill a blender with chopped cabbage, then cover the cabbage with water until the blender is about 2/3 full with water. Blend into a slurry and pour into a crock, jar, or bowl. Repeat a few times for a larger batch. Cover and ferment with or without salt. Ferment a few days, tasting daily. When it tastes ripe, strain out the cabbage, which you can incorporate into food, feed to animals, or compost. The liquid is cultured cabbage juice. I heard about cultured cabbage juice before I specifically developed my interest in fermentation. It was among the many home remedies legendary in the early AIDS treatment underground movement. For people with a disease characterized by wasting away because they are unable to keep food down, liquid infusions were important sources of live cultures and vegetable nutrients, sometimes resulting in dramatic improvements. A 1995 compilation of dietary and other tools for living with AIDS called How to Reverse Immune Dysfunction praises the amazing benefits of cultured cabbage juice and advises drinking 1/2 cup 2 or 3 times a day. Kanji is a delicious spicy Punjabi beverage made by fermenting carrots and mustard seeds in water with salt. It calls for burgundy-colored carrots. If you don't have those, try adding a beet to your carrots. Slice vegetables into matchsticks. Use about 1/2 pound, 250 grams, vegetables, and 1/2 cup, 120 milliliters, ground mustard seeds, along with 2 ounces, 57 grams, or 1/4 cup, salt, with 1/2 gallon, or 2 liters of water. Ferment in a covered vessel in a warm spot for about a week. Strain the veggies out of the liquid and serve chilled. Shalgam suyu is a Turkish beverage and another vegetable ferment in liquid form, a brine from fermented purple carrots and turnip. My friend Luca took me to a Turkish restaurant in London to try this. I loved it. We drank it with rakı, an anise-flavored liquor, each in separate glasses, and they complemented each other perfectly. Tsukemono, Japanese pickling styles. Japanese pickles, called tsukemono, are produced in an extraordinary variety, especially notable for the diversity of media, beyond the typical water and salt in which they are pickled. Vegetables are pickled in miso, shoyu, sake, lees, the residual rice and yeast from sake making, koji, the cultured rice used in both miso and sake, and rice bran. Japanese naturally fermented vegetables tend to have flavors distinctive to one family or shop, or at least to one district, sometimes different from one hamlet to another within the same village, writes Richard Hayo, a U.S.-raised American fermentation enthusiast who married a Japanese woman and has lived for many years in Japan. The flavors tend to have adherence and are often the result of cultures, recipes, and practices handed down from generation to generation within an extended family, and sometimes subject to quite a bit of debate. Like fermentation practices everywhere, the traditional methods of Japanese pickling have been in decline, but there is also a revival underway. Eric Haas, a fermentation enthusiast who spent time traveling in Japan, reports, "I was somewhat surprised and saddened by how few people make their own veggies, and how chemical-infused the grocery store varieties have become. Example, I met one old woman in the middle of nowhere who made pickles according to the traditional style, organic and chemical-free. We got to talking, and it turns out she doesn't like the traditional pickles. She's only been making them for a few years, ever since some man from the big city drove into town and started asking people to make things the traditional way, contracting them out to live the traditional rural fantasy that many Japanese seem to be increasingly interested in. She only eats pickles from the grocery store, full of chemicals that make it taste better. The people I met who were doing the really cool traditional stuff, like fermented veggies, were mainly mid-20s to mid-40s, disenchanted with the pace of conventional Japanese city culture, striving hard to make a life for themselves outside of the noise." Sound familiar? The same countervailing processes are of course happening in the United States, with food traditions being supplanted by homogenized industrial products, then the resulting void catalyzing cultural revival to reclaim those traditions. Don't let food traditions disappear. Be part of the culture of revival. Miso pickles, misozuke, shoyu pickles, shoyuzuke, koji pickles, kojizuke, and pickles in sake lees, kasuzuke or narazuke, are all pretty straightforward once you create or obtain the medium itself. Shoyu pickles are easiest, since it is a liquid. Shoyu may be mixed with rice, vinegar, and or sake, then simply poured over vegetables in a jar. In all the others, with solid pickling media, sliced or whole small vegetables are layered with the medium, so that each piece of vegetable is completely surrounded by the pickling medium, and not in contact with other vegetable pieces. Like sauerkraut, it helps to keep the vegetables weighed down, although at a small scale they can be made in a jar or other small vessel without weight. The different pickling mediums can also be combined into, for instance, miso and sake lees pickles, and other flavorings, such as sake, may be incorporated. Usually vegetables for any of these pickling techniques are first dried somewhat through salt pressing, dry salting vegetables and weighing down for 24 to 48 hours, or air drying. In this way, there is less dilution of the pickling medium by vegetable juices. Miso pickles are generally fermented the longest, sometimes for years, although they are transformed and delicious after just a few days. As vegetables are harvested from the pickling pot, miso, flavored by the vegetables, may be used in soups, sauces, and other cooking. Sake lees pickles are also generally fermented for months or years. Koji pickles, which are very sweet, are usually fermented for the shortest time, just a few days to a week. Prior to burying in koji, or amazake, vegetables are usually salt-pressed. The Japanese pickles that I have made the most are rice bran pickles, nukazuke, because I really love their rich, multi-layered flavor. For these pickles, vegetables are buried in rice bran, the most nutrient-dense part of the rice, which gets removed in milling white rice. Wheat bran or other grain brans may be used instead or in addition. In the Japanese tradition, households generally purchase whole grain rice and bring it themselves to a mill, where they specify how much bran to remove. 10% would be lightly polished, 30% would be typical white rice, the highest grade sakes use rice more than 50% milled. Customers go to the mill with a bag of brown rice and return home with two bags, one of rice and one of bran. Find fresh bran if possible and refrigerate until you make your nuka pot, as bran is oily and can go rancid. I like to gently dry roast the bran in a cast iron pan until it becomes aromatic, and then transfer the roasted bran to a crock, which I aim to fill roughly halfway with bran, then add salt. Recipes I've seen are all over the place on salt, ranging from roughly 5% to 25% of the weight of bran. I prefer the lower end of spectrum, but as with other vegetable ferments, salt to taste. And remember that it is much easier to add more salt if desired than to dilute it. The uniqueness of each Nuka pot is the combination of flavorings in the bran. I like to use powdered mustard, strips of kombu seaweed, shiitake mushroom, hot peppers with stems and seeds removed, garlic, ginger root, miso, and a little sake or beer. Next, add water. In my recipe in wild fermentation, I called for quite a bit of water, 6 cups or 1.5 liters of water plus 1 cup or 250 milliliters of beer for 2 pounds, 1 kilogram, of bran, so that the bran is saturated with water and water rises when the bran is weighed down, resulting in a wet, sludge-like texture that produces delicious pickles. I've received some feedback through the years that Nuka is generally much drier than that. The Nuka pickles I saw in people's homes used a much drier medium, writes Eric Haas. I first learned the Nuka process from Aveline Cushy's Complete Guide to Macrobiotic Cooking, and her recipe calls for 2 cups of water per pound of Nuka, along with weighting the Nuka so that water rises to the top. Most of the other recipes I have found call for much less water and no weight. The most detailed information I've found on Nuka is in Elizabeth Ando's beautiful book, Kansha, Celebrating Japan's Vegan and Vegetarian Traditions. Ando, who moved from the United States to Japan more than 40 years ago, writes that, "My neighbors were surprised at first, shocked really, to discover that I kept pickle pots at all, but have since become willing and enthusiastic babysitters. Cultivating a Nuka pot has provided me with special access to the lives of many Japanese women, pickle bonding across an otherwise difficult cultural divide." Ando describes the Nuka mix as a stiff paste, and her recipe calls for using roughly a quarter as much liquid, water along with beer or sake, as rice bran, by volume, 1 1/4 cups, 300 milliliters liquid, for 1 pound or 500 grams bran, which measures to 4 cups, or 1 liter. Before vegetables are buried in the Nuka pot, they are generally salt-rubbed in a technique called itazuri. With coarse salt in the palm of one hand, roll the vegetable around in the salt for a moment, rubbing its skin with the abrasive salt. This begins the breaking down of the skin of the vegetable and the release of fluids. If this causes any foamy white release of bitter compounds from the vegetables, eku, rinse them before burying in the pickling medium. Start out your Nuka pot by adding just a single vegetable at a time. Make sure the vegetable is completely covered by bran. Smooth out the surface of the Nuka and wipe any residual bran from the sides of the vessel. Cover the Nuka pot with a cloth to allow it to breathe while also keeping flies and dust out. The next day, remove the first piece of vegetable, stir the Nuka pot with your clean hand, and add another salt-rubbed vegetable. Repeat several times with one vegetable at a time until the harvested vegetables start to have a distinctive pickled flavor. Ando calls this conditioning the Nuka paste. Lapsed time is necessary for the paste to be ready, and rather than leave the pot empty, which would increase the time it takes to get the good bacteria going, you need to add something to it. Once the Nuka crock is cultured, you can bury more vegetables in it. They can be whole or chopped into bite-sized pieces, and fermented for different lengths of time. Ando describes her Nuka rhythm. In the spring and fall, an active pot ripens vegetables into flavorful pickles in 8 to 12 hours. I typically put vegetables in my pot after breakfast to enjoy for dinner the same night. When daytime temperatures rise above 80 degrees Fahrenheit or 27 degrees Celsius, the vegetables will take only 6 hours, often less, to reach maturity, which means I can put vegetables in the pot in early afternoon and still enjoy them for dinner. If I must be out of the house all day during warm weather, I put the vegetables in the pot the night before, remove them in the morning, and then refrigerate them with the paste still clinging to them. That night I rinse off the paste and serve them. When temperatures drop below 45 degrees Fahrenheit or 7 degrees Celsius, it will take at least 15 hours, or possibly 20 or 24 hours, to achieve a ripe flavor. In the cold months, I add the vegetables to the pot at night after dinner to enjoy the following evening. If the vegetables remain in the Nuka paste after they have reached maturity, they turn very sour. Furuzuke, as these old pickles are known, have their fans, much like the folks who like very sour dill pickles. I'm one of those people who love furuzuke. Experiment with length of fermentation and figure out what you like best. As you harvest vegetables from the Nuka pot, take care to brush as much of the Nuka bran as you can from the vegetables back into the crock. With proper maintenance, a Nuka crock can be used in perpetuity. The key to maintaining a Nuka pot is to mix it every day. You will need to add salt periodically, since salt absorbs into the vegetables and migrates out with them over time. Other flavorings and the bran itself also need occasional refreshing. If you go away, store the Nuka paste in the refrigerator. One final very special Japanese pickle is Takuan. Whole daikon radishes pickled in rice bran for 6 months, a year, or longer, yielding delicious pickles with a delicate earthy quality. To start, hang daikon radishes in the sun to dry for 1 to 2 weeks with their tops intact. Hanging them in front of a sunny window is easiest, if possible. If you hang them outdoors, bring them in each evening so they are not wet by dew. As the daikons dry out, they become much lighter and also flexible. Once you can easily bend them, they are ready for pickling. Trim away leaves, save them for the top of the crock, and then roll each daikon root back and forth on a flat surface with your hands and press to soften any hard spots. Following a recipe posted online by a blogger, I pickled the radishes in 15% bran and 6% salt, based on the weight of the radishes, much diminished by the drying period. This involved weighing the radishes and calculating, and then weighing out appropriate amounts of bran and salt. If you do not have a scale, that comes to roughly 2 tablespoons of salt and 1/2 cup of bran per pound, 500 grams, of dried radishes. Mix the bran and salt along with dried persimmon skins for color. If available, a few pieces of kombu and some chili pepper or sake if desired. Spread a thin layer of the pickling mixture at the bottom of your crock, then a layer of daikons, which can curl and contort with their new flexibility. Stuff any small pockets between daikons with their leaves, aiming to leave as little airspace as possible. Cover the daikon layer with another thin layer of pickling mixture, then another layer of radishes, another layer of bran pickling mix, and so on, making sure to finish with a layer of the pickling mixture. Cover the top layer with the remaining daikon leaves, then a plate and a heavy weight. Secure a cloth over the top and leave to ferment in a cool spot for at least a season or as long as several years. Ideas for cooking fermented vegetables. Marinate and or stew meat in them and their brines. The acidity and bacteria help tenderize meat. Bigos is a Polish style of stewing meat in sauerkraut. Choucroute garni is an Alsatian style. Pancakes. Kimchi pancakes are frequently found in Korean cuisine. Incorporate any finely shredded vegetable ferment into savory sourdough pancakes. Soup. Kimchi jjigae, kimchi soup, is a Korean staple. Sauté onions, vegetables, and bite-sized pieces of pork belly or other meat, if desired. Once the onions and meat are browned, add kimchi and continue to sauté a few minutes. Then add stock, tofu, and soy sauce and bring to a boil. Adjust the seasonings and enjoy. Shi is a comparable Russian soup, made with sauerkraut or sometimes just unfermented cabbage. Russian cuisine also uses pickled brine, rasol, as a soup base, especially for cold summer soups. Beet kvass can be used as base for borscht. Fermented vegetables can be either a central element or a minor flavoring agent in soups or used as a garnish. Pierogi, strudels, pies, and dumplings. Sauerkraut is a classic stuffing for pierogi and savory phyllo dough pies and strudels. Similarly, Korean cuisine features kimchi-filled dumplings. In the Balkans, whole fermented cabbage leaves serve as wrappings for sarma, stuffed cabbage. Cakes. Like buttermilk or sourdough, sauerkraut can be used as the acidic element to react with alkaline baking soda in baking. Community cookbooks from areas with histories of German settlement frequently include recipes for sauerkraut cakes. Cooking with fermented vegetables. I have emphasized eating fermented vegetables raw because I believe that their most profound nutritional benefit is the live bacterial cultures in them, which are destroyed by cooking. Yet, in the cultures in which they evolved, fermented vegetables are frequently used in cooking as well. As long as you make sure to eat some of the ferments raw, there is no reason not to enjoy them cooked, too. La Pette, fermented tea leaves. La Pette is an unusual vegetable ferment. Leaves of the tea plant, Camellia sinensis, pickled to be eaten, from the Southeast Asian nation of Burma. Adele Carpenter of San Francisco, California, who first brought them to my attention, writes, "They are an extremely delicious salty pickled pulp served with fried nuts and seeds and lemon as a salad at Burmese restaurants." To make la pâte, fresh tea leaves are steamed for about an hour, then spread on bamboo mats and hand-mashed. The mashed leaves are then packed into a vessel, traditionally a bamboo-lined pit, heavily weighted to expel air and compress the leaf mass, and fermented from several months to as long as a year. The travel diary of a tea importer explains how to eat la pâte. The pickled, sour-tasting tea leaves are mixed with ginger, garlic, chilies, oil, and salt, and all eaten together. My friend Susie sent me a package of la pâte imported from Burma that she found at a market in Philadelphia. "This stuff is quite honestly one of my favorite dishes of all time," she wrote. I made a salad of lettuce and la pâte, seasoned as described above. It was an explosion of flavor. The friends I served it to oohed and aahed and returned for another taste. Susie is growing tea on her Alabama farm, but has to wait for the shrubs to mature a few years before she can attempt la pâte. Troubleshooting. Ferment is or isn't foamy. Don't worry, foaming is common, especially in the first few days of fermentation. Skim persistent foam off the surface and discard. Foaming slows down very quickly and can be imperceptible. It is entirely possible that you will never notice any bubbles. It's okay. Ferment develops yeast or mold surface molds. Surface growth is very common. Do not be alarmed. Do not compost your kraut. Skim off the mold as best you can, and don't be concerned if a little of it dissipates. Ferment is too salty. Add a little water, mix it around for a moment, and taste. Repeat if necessary. If you need to add a lot of water, pour off the excess. If you add just a bit, treat it as extra sauerkraut juice. In some traditions, vegetables are fermented with lots of salt and then rinsed off before eating. Extra salt can preserve veggies longer, but the problem with rinsing is that you also rinse away nutrients and bacteria. Ferment has a strong odor. Fermenting vegetables emit strong odors. This is normal and generally not a problem. If you or those you live with are bothered by the smell, you can try fermenting in a semi-outdoor ventilated space, provided that it not get wet or excessively hot or cold. Fermenting in jars is another approach. When you release the pressure as described earlier, just do it out the window. Greg Large ferments vegetables in an airlocked vessel with a plastic tube venting the bubbles that come through the airlock right out the window. The result was no smell at all in the house and no mold. A truly putrid smell can indicate a number of problems and is typically accompanied by long-growing, deep-penetrating surface growth of some sort that needs to be removed. Many times I have removed top layers that were obnoxious and offensive in their smell and appearance from long-fermenting barrels and crocks full of vegetables, only to discover gorgeous, mouth-wateringly aromatic, delicious krautchi a few inches below. Ferment is mushy, not crunchy. Unless inhibited by low temperatures, high salinity, tannins, and/or other factors, enzymes in vegetables will eventually, given enough time, break down the pectins that give vegetables their crunchiness. This will happen fastest in watery vegetables like cucumbers and summer squash. But given enough time, especially in conjunction with warm temperatures or low salinity, even cabbage can go soft. It's perfectly safe to eat soft. Some people even prefer it that way. Ferment is slimy with thick, viscous brine. Sometimes fermenting vegetables develop thick, gooey, viscous, almost ropey brine. In some cases, this is a fleeting stage of development. As successive metabolic processes proceed, the sliminess disappears. In other cases, the batch remains slimy. The production of slime and sauerkraut has never been thoroughly investigated, according to The Microbiology of Fermented Foods. Another technical reference, Modern Food Microbiology, states that slimy kraut is caused by the rapid growth of L. curcumeris and L. plantarum, especially at elevated temperatures. My experience corroborates the idea that slimy krauts most often develop in warmer than ideal fermentation temperatures. Wait for cooler weather and try again. Ferment turns pink. Pink kraut is great if the color comes from red cabbages, radishes, beets, or fruit. But sometimes kraut from white cabbages turns pink due to a pigment produced by yeasts, typically present in kraut, in an environment in which salinity is greater than about 3%. The pink kraut is perfectly safe to eat. In large commercial vats of sauerkraut, improper distribution of salt can result in areas of pink kraut, indicating excessive salt, and areas of soft kraut, indicating insufficient salt. Maggots are crawling in your ferment. It is imperative to protect food you are aging from flies. Otherwise, they will find it and lay eggs on it, and when the eggs hatch, you will find maggots crawling out of your food. I protect fermenting crocks from flies with old sheets or other finely woven cotton fabrics. In the summer months when flies are most plentiful, I tie a string around the cloth to secure its edges. If you do find maggots in your crouchy, there is no need to panic or discard the whole batch. As they hatch on the surface of a ferment, maggots migrate up and out of the food. They do not burrow further down. Remove the top inch or so of the fermenting vegetables and go as deep as necessary until you reach kraut cheese with no sign of maggots, no discoloration, and a pleasant aroma. Be sure to wipe the interior sides of the vessel to remove any lingering maggots or eggs, and don't forget to secure a cover to protect the kraut cheese from more flies landing on it.